Now we're about to talk to Taylor Branch, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author in history for Parting the Waters, the first of the incredible trilogy, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, and numerous other books, to join us here with his reflections. And Taylor, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
So, Taylor, let's just begin, as I've done with everybody. Where were you on this day when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and what happened to you on that day?
Well, it was quite memorable. I was sitting in a small office at my high school. I was a senior in high school, and I was sitting in a small office with I think he was a major from the U.S. Army who was the recruiter for football from West Point. And we were talking about whether or not I wanted to go play football at West Point. I knew I didn't, but I was curious about first of all, it got me out of class. Uh-huh. And second of all, I was curious about how they would pitch a career in the Army at that time. This is pre-Vietnam. It's very innocent. And the secretary stuck her head, because we had secretaries back in those days, stuck her head in the office and said, "Excuse me, the president has been shot in Dallas." And the recruiter, who was in full Army uniform, stood up and didn't say a word and stood up and saluted, because the woman who poked her head in clearly was in shock. I mean, it was not a neutral announcement. It unnerved him, or his reflex was to stand up and salute. And he held this salute for what seemed like an eternity. He didn't know what to do. And he finally said, "Well, I guess we'll have to take this up another time." I was shocked. I wanted to run and find a television. To my school's credit, there weren't very many televisions. It was hard to find one. So people basically, classes let out, and people were wandering around listening to things, finding the teachers who had radios. Selfishly, however, I will say that in the midst of all the shock of a young kid, the president being shot, we were scheduled to play that night, my high school football team, for the championship of North Georgia in the toughest division. And our big worry was our game going to be postponed or not? And it was. We didn't play Friday night. We played Saturday night. That was my last high school football game. I separated my shoulder in the second quarter, sat out, and was in a lot of pain, taking painkillers on Sunday morning when I watched Jack Ruby shoot Lee Harvey Oswald on live television.
Mm.
It was memorable, but it was innocent. It was all wrapped up in where you're going to go to college and high school football, and I'm sure that I'm not unusual. I bet we watched 15 to 20 hours of television over that weekend, the news and seeing Walter Cronkite be so emotional, and right on through the funeral and the little pictures that are now icons of John Kennedy saluting the caisson,
right,
with his father on it, not really knowing what was going on. I remember it as like the end of innocence at a time when I was 16.
End of innocence is an expression that so many people have used for this moment. Yeah, and it was because just watching, I mean, knowing the assassination and then Jack Ruby shooting Oswald and the rest. It really was the beginning of the end of innocence for a lot of people. I was wondering, Taylor, given we were talking to Freeman Hrabowski earlier. He was reflecting on being in Birmingham, Alabama, and a civil rights kid, and what all that meant for him at that particular moment. And you were a Southern kid as well, but I would assume in a mostly white or all white school in Georgia, high school.
All white.
So, how was the reaction? What was the reaction in your community, in the community in the high school, and around you at that moment?
It was shock. It was an all white, segregated school that was religious. I was there on a scholarship. I did the laundry. My dad did the laundry for the athletic department in exchange for my tuition.
Uh-huh.
It was like Gilman. It was a nice, high quality prep school, except that it was overtly religious. And in that sense, we teenagers were acutely sensitive to hypocrisy, in the sense that they were saying they were a Christian preparatory school and it was an accident that there were no black kids there.
Mm.
And we didn't, kids are attuned to that sort of thing. And so we knew that there was something wrong, and it had already started to corrode any sense of respect, not only for segregation, but for people, the assurance assurance of elders that they had everything under control, it was plain that they were frightened of it and only had to pretend and were contradicting themselves, which really it was corrosive to our education. Atlanta had just adopted in that same year a city slogan that it still has, with a lot of fanfare, that Atlanta was the city too busy to hate. And the mayor still says that because of the civil rights upheaval. And the kids I knew in our school were saying, my gosh, this is our city slogan, and the slogan itself says that if we don't really keep busy, our natural inclination is to hate.
Mm-hmm. So right, right.
If that's what we're going to brag about, what would we confess? So it was an early time to me. It was a time of questioning within a world that still was trying to present a natural order of segregation as something that was defensible at a Christian preparatory school in Atlanta. And here comes this shock. Everybody knew, you know, Kennedy had just proposed the Civil Rights Bill, and he was associated with civil rights, and people were wondering, well, did he get killed because of that? And even Johnson said, somehow we know this has something to do with hatred, and we must purge ourselves of hatred. So in that sense, it really was the beginning of a very primitive welling up of what are we all about? Where is this hatred coming from? Are we all hiding? What are we hiding from? And for me as a 16-year-old, this was it was just a lot of questions opening up, you know, under my feet.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Taylor.
And I think a lot of people were like that. We were unnerved.
Yeah, I think all of us were at that moment, unnerved.
How can this happen? And how can the assassin get killed in custody? You know, it felt like a banana republic with a real strong undercurrent of we're not what we seem.
So, Taylor, let me ask you this question as Taylor Branch, the historian. And it was during the heart of your books when this occurred,
mm-hmm.
and your studies, and what that, in a larger sense, what this assassination meant, especially in the civil rights movement, especially when it comes to the battle to end segregation, and how it does in any way to you now, looking back historically, speak to this moment we're in.
Well, from a cold-hearted perspective, it helped pass the Civil Rights Bill.
Yeah.
Of 1964. Kennedy was having a very hard time even getting it through committee in the House, which they controlled. and really, I think the emotional shock combined with the immediate intuitive announcement by Lyndon Johnson that the best memorial to the slain president would be to pass the civil rights bill that he had just introduced as a essential step to confront hatred in the land were both very, very important. It made it hard to oppose the civil rights bill in that emotional atmosphere, and that combined with Johnson's legislative skill probably got the bill passed when it wouldn't otherwise have passed, and in that sense makes President Kennedy a martyr to the Civil Rights Act in a literal sense that his death was very likely a necessary cause to get the bill passed. That it's hard to imagine how he would have gotten it passed had he stayed on as president.
Right.
Some people may dispute me on that, but It certainly shifted the whole emotional center of the country in a direction of we can't avoid this. We have to do something. There's hatred involved here, and we've got to get past our denial. So in that sense, I think the circumstances of the death and the grief and the national shock were probably as important as anything else President Kennedy ever did.
And again, as a historian, and you're always also commenting on what we're facing in America and the world today, with that perspective. And we remember this day and this anniversary because it's 50 years. It's all over the news. Everybody's saying something about it. in the media, including us. But I'm curious what you feel about what that effect is. What is the effect on history? The effect of that in this moment on us in the 21st century. Do you know what I mean? I mean, history can really affect the moment you're in, even when we don't know it's affecting the moment we're in.
Well, this assassination is coming back with tremendous force for those of us who lived through it. I myself am curious about what people 20 years old who were not born for 30 more years, how they look on it. It has a hold in the culture, in the media culture, in part because television was a young medium, and just in the sense of national culture, for 200 million people to be glued to television on news without commercials on the same emotional formative events around the president had a very powerful, long-lasting effect. And I think that it has sealed kind of the charm of the Kennedys and the charm of Camelot in a kind of a celebrity way, warring emotionally in the sense of history for all the lessons that were deeper than that. Remember, the loss of innocence on the surface that everybody felt that day, that our president had been shot in our civilized country and then the assassin had been shot and killed, was only the beginning of things that were the loss of innocence. Nobody had any idea at that time of revelations to come that President Kennedy and his brother had just approved wiretaps on Martin Luther King, that through the CIA they had been trying to kill Fidel Castro, that those assassination attempts involved gangsters, and that the president was, you know, having an affair that he shared with a gangster. These were unnerving or unsettling revelations about a loss of innocence that would take another, I don't know, 15 or 20 years to undermine kind of the gloss of Camelot. And for that reason, I think history is still kind of warring over the Kennedys between the charm and a television president who was like Cary Grant. And yet there were a lot of less attractive features of raw power going on behind the scenes that are warring over that, and I think that still is an issue for the United States. That's one we're trying to cling to Camelot, but everybody knows that there were all these more substantive issues beneath that. It's kind of charm versus character. How much can charm redeem character, and how much can it inform it, and how much of is it our duty to say these were important times, but the character issues and the issues of how we relate to one another are more important than whether or not we think John Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy were like Princess Diana.
Well, Taylor Branch, I really do appreciate this, and I also appreciate your analysis and be able to keep it very real, and to never, as you do not do, pull your punches and look at our history the way we have to look at it, with a kind of cold, clear eye, but with passion underneath. And I appreciate all you do and appreciate you being part of this conversation today.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed it.